have had a day or a day and a half of very, very interesting dialogue, thanks to the quality of the two people on either side of me, whom I will briefly introduce for those of you who are meeting them for the first time. To my left is Jennifer Hochschild, who's a professor of African and African-American Studies and Political Science at Harvard University, and the author most recently, the fourth or fifth book, of The American Dream in the Public Schools, which I can heartily recommend to you. To my right is Jay Green, who's the Endowed Professor of Education in the Department of Education at the University of Arkansas and a longtime associate of the Manhattan Institute in New York City. And I didn't bring my packet this time, but I have a packet of not all of Jay's articles. They're not the complete works, I don't think, but about this thick, which are worth encountering. And his book, Education Myths, even more worth encountering. He's a clever as well as good thinker, so this book will both infuriate and puzzle and make your life difficult in useful ways. So I recommend this too. They are the scholar slash experts here in our discussion about what do our public schools need. It's my job, after they have been talked to death and talked out for the better part of 2 days, to try to get as much more good talk out of them as I can. But I have to plead with you to help me by asking the most difficult questions you can, and when they say things that don't satisfy you, to push hard back. I promise I'll do my bit as well, but I do want your help. I'm going to start by posing some questions that I have that I would like both Jennifer and Jay to reflect upon, but I want, before I do that, to stress that it is not my intention or wish for this to be exactly a debate. I do not expect or hope that people with two such good minds as these will not disagree with each other. Disagreement is to be invited, encouraged, and played with. Debate for me seems mostly a waste of time, and I'm not very interested in it and never have been. So, you know, they may find themselves in opposition at certain moments, and they may not at others, but our job here is not to get them debating with each other, but to have a deepening conversation which goes yet further, we hope, than we have so far about difficult things. What do our public schools need? That has been the frame of our work. And so I thought it might be the best place to begin to ask each of these two people to list as briefly as they can stand what their primary answers to that question would be. That is, what do our public schools need? If you were beginning with four or five or six, the number doesn't matter exactly, what roughly would you put as the most urgent?
Can we start?
Sure.
Okay. This answer largely comes out of the research literature. Those who have been faithfully sitting with us for the last 2 days will hear nothing new, I'm afraid to say, but let me say it anyway. Probably the single most important thing that makes a difference in the quality of students' lives and the quality of their outcomes is good teaching. Right. That's almost a tautology, right? How do we know what good teaching is? It makes a difference in students' lives. What is most important for students' lives is good teaching. But it isn't quite a tautology. And that seems to me one of the things we need to think very hard about is how to identify what counts as good teaching, and the answer to that in part depends on what you think the goals of schooling are. Entirely sort of private-oriented achievement, largely collective-oriented around sort of democratic citizenship, perhaps group identity, perhaps something else. So in any case, there's a long conversation, we may get into it further, about sort of how we identify what counts as good teaching, and then separately how we identify what counts as a good teacher. And the very short answer there, again, this is not news to anybody probably in this room, is that it's extremely difficult to do that a priori, but relatively easy to do that a posteriori, which we can tell retrospectively who has been a good teacher, but it's extremely difficult to predict that. And so schools both have a clear goal and a totally unclear way of getting to that goal. So that's very complicated. I believe that a second answer of what we know from the research literature, and so therefore in some sense what schools don't need, is choice broadly defined. It seems to me that voucher programs, and here Jay will clearly disagree with me, the research literature suggests that they don't have much negative impact, but they actually don't have very much positive impact either. And the amount of sort of political energy devoted to debates over vouchers probably isn't worth, the game's not worth a candle. That might be true for charter schools, but I think both the evidence is less clear and the likely political politically likely expansion of charter schools is greater. So I think that's a slightly different question. I would want to separate that. I think a third thing that schools need is for us to think more imaginatively about the structure of the schooling environment, schooling context, and the structure of the schooling process, which is to say districts are the creature of states. There have, in various points in American history, been the creation of districts and then the uncreation, the consolidation, the elimination of districts. They tend to be assumed in any discussion of school reform, either in terms of student movement or teacher movement or negotiation with unions or anything else. But districts are a political creation which perhaps could be changed. The same thing with our sort of standard assumptions about the structure of schooling. Why does it go from September through May when we no longer need students to go out into the fields to harvest in the summer? Why does it go from 8 to 2:30 when my teenage son is barely awake before noon? Why don't we use schools in the evenings and the weekends and the summers? Why do we have age-graded grades when six-year-olds may be very good at grade at some subject and very poor at some other subject, and so on? There's a whole lot of sort of assumptions about what a school is, what a school district is, what a schooling process or schedule is, that perhaps were established for very good reasons however many years ago, but those are political judgments. Schools are a public enterprise, for better or for worse. I think for better. Jay thinks probably for worse. So why don't we take more advantage, use more advantage of the leverage that a State Department of Education has, perhaps a district has, perhaps a region has, to rethink what the schooling process ought to look like. So I'll stop there.
Sure.
I don't entirely disagree, as we find that we agree a lot, but my emphasis is slightly different. I think that the primary problem in public education has been that we have been increasing resources devoted to education at a pretty rapid clip, and yet results have remained flat for a very long time. So we have a productivity crisis. We have doubled per pupil spending adjusted for inflation over the last three decades, and yet achievement scores for 17-year-olds or graduation rates or however you want to measure outcomes have not improved. And this is a very frustrating situation because 1970 skills were fine for 1970, but they're clearly not adequate now. And anytime you double your effort at something, you might reasonably expect that something good should occur in return. And there were and to compound this problem, there are horrible inequities in that flat achievement that have remained unchanged for a very long period of time, and they really need to be addressed if we're going to improve political equity within our society and efficacy in political terms across different racial, ethnic, and class lines. And so if simply increasing resources has not been an effective strategy, what might be? What could help us get better results in exchange for the resources we devote or additional resources we might decide to devote in the future? And my argument is that we need to attend to the incentives within the education system to perform better and not simply their resources to perform. One of the central problems with public education is that resources are in no way attached to performance. So it doesn't matter in particular, for anyone in the public education system, whether things get better or not, to receive the resources they currently receive or to receive more resources in the future. And by detaching resources from outcomes, we have undermined incentives. Now, happily, we have a lot of very good, well-intentioned people who work very hard in our public education system, which helps it be as good as it is. But My argument would be that we can help it become better if we could add some additional incentives or motivation on top of that already existing goodwill. And the incentives in education, incentive reforms, come in two flavors, choice and accountability. And they're essentially the same thing. They're just different mechanisms for producing the same thing. Accountability is centrally determined goals, centrally determined definition of what a good outcome is, and then this central determination of rewards or sanctions attached to satisfaction of that centrally determined goal. So there's some bar that's called passing. Kids get over that bar. Good things happen to school districts or schools or principals or teachers or students, whoever it is that is incentivized here. But in the accountability system, there's some bar that's passing. Good things happen if students hit the bar. Bad things happen if they don't. And that's the incentive approach of an accountability system. Choice is and choice and competition is the same thing, except rather than centrally determining the goals, we decentrally determine the goals. That is, every family decides what it is seeking out of this educational process, and they have a variety of goals, many of which overlap, but they're not identical. And each individual family controls resources so that they can reward or sanction people for satisfying or failing to satisfy their goals from their from the education. So they're incentive systems, one centralized, one's decentralized. Now, there is pretty good evidence that both reform strategies, both incentive reform strategies, can help produce improvement. And I think both may well be desirable. But I prefer choice and competition over accountability, although one need not necessarily choose. But I would put more emphasis on that because I think it is more efficient and more comprehensive and less easy to manipulate if the goals are decentrally determined and decentrally assigning rewards and sanctions than if they're centrally determined. First, I think it helps respect the diversity of our goals and the diversity of our preferences in a pluralistic society if we accommodate that the diversity of goals in the form of choice and competition as opposed to in a centralized accountability system. And it's not as easy for people within the education to teach to the test or cheat or otherwise manipulate a centrally determined outcome or politically control the very people who centrally determine what those goals are. And so I think there's less room for capture or manipulation if we use the decentralized approach. So that's my preferred reform strategy.
Okay. I think both of you, in different ways, have illustrated one of the deepest problems with school reform efforts. And this, and by this, I mean something not at all to put anybody down. Jay, somewhat partially, Jennifer, almost not at all, has answered the question, what do schools need? You answered the question, what do schools not need? And we can answer those questions better, in my experience, than we can answer the positive question.
We can answer the what do schools not need better.
Yes, much better. And even Jay's more affirmative answer to the question, for me at least, has very, very serious problems with it. The evidence is by no means in that accountability measures and standards, as we've experienced them over the last decade, have made a difference where it matters to make a difference. There's evidence that says they have. It's not evidence I put much trust in, quite bluntly. And my concern here, I should make clear, is urban and rural schools, which are primarily populated by the children of poor, working, and lower middle class parents. And in those schools, though there has been arguably some measure of improvement, there is hardly enough. And accountability and standards have not demonstrated their ability to make that improvement. Perhaps in another 10 years, but one of the stories of educational reform in the United States is every 10 years there's a new way we do it. And the old disappears before we've had a time to test what duration would produce. So that Jay could be right in arguing for vouchers even, though I, like Jennifer, am deeply dubious, and the evidence doesn't, I think, support him at all.
Do charters make you happier?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm happy with that, too. It doesn't matter to me, really. I mean, I prefer vouchers right. over charters. But
the point here I want to make is that if voucher experiments could run for 25 years, we might, and on a somewhat larger scale, we might find out things we would not find out in 10. So there's always this problem, at least in the American educational system, that we don't stay with experiments long enough, I think, to genuinely test them, to know what works. And there is a dilemma at the heart of these more better than well-intentioned responses. For me, the presence of good teachers in fairly decent physical surroundings are at the center. We do not know how to produce reliably good teachers in sufficient number to cover our educational system. And here's a point Jay, I suspect, has made several times, but he certainly made it at our opening together at the President's House, to remember that there are 3 million teachers, give or take. That's an extraordinary number of people to get to be excellent in the ways we need in our classrooms. It's an extraordinary number. The fact that we have as many first-rate teachers as we do in public school is, in a sense, miraculous. It shouldn't be. Not necessarily because of low salaries, not necessarily because they're given too little autonomy, not necessarily because they're not treated like professionals. Those all have their factors here. But how we draw promising candidates for good teaching into the schools and how we mentor them are completely unanswered questions. All sorts of experiments, some of them more promising than others, but on much smaller scales even than the experiments with vouchers. That is to say, if I can say to Jay, oh, come on, you've only got 1% of the schooling population on vouchers, he can turn around to me and say, yeah, but all the teacher education things that you can cite are truly tiny. We don't know how they would work. So we have this difficult problem that even if you answer what do our schools need and you say, as I have somewhat simple-mindedly, decent physical facilities and first-rate teachers, my two companions would, I hope, jump on me instantly and say, great, how do you get these? These are physical facilities, of course, is the easiest part. But they don't do any good if you don't have good teachers in them. So starting with this question, I guess I want to underscore that something I think all three of us agree on, that what happens in public education might be one of the two or three most important things in our lives in the United States, and that the resources we have to think through how to go about making schools better are actually too limited. How we'd make them less limited also seems to me a hard question. The three of us agree, for instance, that all the forms we know about to produce better teachers aren't terribly effective. Most schools of education are mediocre at best. Teach for America is utterly problematic, and that is my mildest statement about that organization. State and city teaching fellow corps are mostly self-interested ways of getting bodies into classrooms. They don't necessarily produce better teachers. They don't necessarily keep better teachers from happening, but there's nothing about them that's dependable. There's the occasional exception, like the Mississippi Teacher Corps, but it's tiny. So there's a dilemma I just want to put up, not yet to try to respond to. We may come back around to it, but it seems to me a very important one.
I think we might.
Go ahead.
If I could be as bold as to suggest that nothing will solve all problems. However, I think that we would have reason to believe that expanding choice and competition might help address issues related to, for example, teacher quality, or issues related to sufficient physical plans for schools, because it has to do with the efficient allocation of resources and proper incentive systems. And now, of course, you can't fix everything, and you can't. we can't centrally plan how we can't in this room figure out how exactly we train all teachers and how exactly where we assign them to go work. And in fact, I think this is one of the problems of this kind of discussion is that bright people getting together have the conceit of trying to figure out exactly how everything should be. And I don't know how everything should be, and I don't think anyone knows how it should be. And there probably are a lot of different things that are good for a lot of different people. And the way we arrive at those kinds of solutions is that we empower people to find solutions for themselves and figure out ways of solving these things themselves, and we give them proper incentives to work it out. And so how do we attract better people into teaching? Well, we free up the current system, which requires uniform pay in ways that are completely unrelated to performance, and we allow the rewarding of excellent people in teaching, which might help attract more excellent people into teaching. How do we get better physical plant? Well, we provide incentives for schools to more efficiently allocate their capital in how they build and maintain schools. I mean, you have to always wonder why it is that we see DC schools and the roof is crumbling and the toilet doesn't work, and they get almost $20,000 per pupil per year, right? So, I mean, when you look at all the broken stuff, you'll say, oh, this school is horribly underfunded. But then that's the wrong place to look. You have to ask yourself, how in the world do you have a system where you can provide really just enormous resources per pupil for K-12 education, and basic things don't work. The roof doesn't work, the toilet doesn't work. And it's because it doesn't make a difference to anyone in the system on the margin whether things are done well or poorly, whether things are maintained or not maintained, whether things are built well or not built well. If we immunize everyone from the consequences of their decisions, we should expect, on average, worse decisions. And the general framework that I'm proposing is that we should make there be consequences related to decisions. And if people experience consequences, on average, they will make better decisions.
Well, I certainly agree with you that some comprehensive or centrally dictated set of reforms won't work. On the other hand, market mechanisms, especially at this moment, are not exactly free of problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we would be foolish if we thought markets by themselves could produce the right kinds of changes. And if you say, okay, you can set up certain incentives, so you shape the nature of the market, which is what you're suggesting, that is indeed itself, in some sense, a centrally directed reform. That may be all right if it works. Because you would, I think, say, if you set up the right incentives, it still leaves lots of room for variety. And therefore, things will work better. Jennifer, what do you think about this?
Well, I first of all think that we're just not going to do that. So I mean, and again, I'm repeating myself a little bit. The amount of public support for broadly expanded for voucher programs, a little separate from charter schools, is pretty close to non-existent. I mean, we've had a bunch of referenda. We've had a lot of state legislatures. I think this is an interesting intellectual exercise to debate about how we would set up the relationship between the appropriate set of public controls and the appropriate set of private incentives. And it might even be the case that the three of us would actually come to some kind of agreement around that. I'm not sure we would. But it feels a little scholastic, right? I mean, sort of angels dancing on the head of a pin kind of quality. I don't see any state legislature transforming itself into a privatized, market-based system, even with state legislative or state executive. I don't see any district abolishing itself. So I think the sort of the logic of saying incentives matter is clearly right. The logic of saying resources matter in the context of incentives, or incentives matter in the context of resources, I mean, is right. And then the question to me is, given a public school system, which both is going to persist and, in my view, ought to persist, how do we think about providing appropriate incentives? We have teacher unions. They're not going to go away. We have school districts. I've posited the idea that they could, in principle, go away, but that's at least as unlikely as sort of districts abolishing themselves and turning into voucher systems. We have a bunch of genuine real political constraints. So I guess I think the conversation ought to be, there's a real value to saying, well, you know, if I could reinvent the public school system, how would I do it? I would depublicize it to start with. I would do something, something, something. But I think there's, the, I mean, the scholastic quality of that conversation makes me nervous. I mean, there's a lot of kids who are getting really poor educations right now.
Well, let me suggest that it's
not going to happen.
I think it is happening. But I think the wrong place to look is in vouchers. It's true that vouchers enroll a very small number of children compared to the national scheme. There are a little more than 100,000 kids total in publicly funded voucher or tax credit scholarship programs in the country out of a K-12 public school population of 50 million. So it's really small. However, vouchers make the world safe for charters. Were it not for the constant threat of voucher programs, we wouldn't have had, and we will not have, the expansion of charters that we've had. And charters have 1.2 million kids.
Out of 50 million, that's not a huge number.
This is 1.2 million out of 50 million from a base of zero in 1991. So within less than two decades, we've enrolled more than a million kids in a new type of school, and in particular districts, the places, by the way, where we are beginning to where we have some of the most severe problems, we're beginning to see some real critical mass. So, for example, in D.C., we're now beginning to hit almost a quarter of the school population in charter schools. In Albany, it's going to approach half of the school population. And so there actually are going to be some big urban school districts that are going to be very largely charter. And now charters are a constrained form of choice and competition, a regulated form. But I agree with Barry that any kind of market that we're going to describe here is a regulated market and should be a regulated market. And charters might be a perfectly reasonable way of structuring and regulating that kind of market.
But, Jay, you've said one thing that is the first truly ideological thing I've called you at.
Okay.
Vouchers have nothing to do with charters, despite your argument. And I would say this, that one of the great pleasures, I really take delight in this, is that the right-wing ideologues who've done the worst damage to our public school system recently.
Uh-huh.
Not to make an ideological statement.
Yeah,
no. Right. Oh, no, I'm not staring away from that at all.
Okay.
But believed that charter schools were one of the recipes. And what happened with charter schools and why they have spread is that all kinds of unlikely groups of people have found them a mechanism. That is to say, it is a perfect innovation, which resulted in all sorts of unintended consequences by the first generators of ideas. Community groups have created charter schools. Teachers who are unhappy with particular public schools have created charter schools. They're coming from all over the place. I'm willing to predict that I think the top-down created ones, as in D.C., will be the ones who will do least well.
Oh, this is the mom and pop versus the chain you're talking about?
I really am.
You like the mom and pops. You don't like the chains like Kip? Or you do like Kip?
I do not like Kip, no. Kip fakes its data a lot, I think, but that's another.
Kip, by the way, for the students who are involved in the program, is the program, if you remember, that the Thurnstroms are describing it with very high praise in the reading that I asked you to do. So you know what Kip is.
It's a chain of charter schools
founded,
around the country.
Founded by alums of Teach for America, very closely associated with Teach for America. And
you really don't like
the source of evil.
No, it's not the source of evil. It's a source for false claims.
Okay.
And there are many KIPP schools that have done really very impressive work. I would not take away from that at all. But there is plenty of evidence that they do two things, and depending on your perceptions, you may find this unhappy or acceptable. One is doing what's called cherry picking, that is choosing students that by one means or another they think will do better in the school. And the other is very, very quickly getting rid of those students who do not perform well in the schools, so that that after a year in a KIPP school, the population is going to be a population more likely to succeed in responding to what KIPP does than others. That is to dump a whole set of kids back into the public school system that KIPP, with all of its resources and its claims, can't deal with.
But let me tell you about the evidence on charter schools more broadly. There have now been three random assignment experiments on the effects of charter schools on students who attend them. Random assignment research is like medical research, where there's a lottery, and some people by chance get the treatment, and some people by chance don't. So there are a limited number of spots in the charter school. They have a lottery. Some people get in. Some people get turned away. On average, the two groups are going to be identical in their background. And because we know that background factors have such a strong influence on educational achievement, that random assignment research is really the gold standard because it helps us eliminate or largely eliminate the possibility that it's unobserved and uncontrolled differences in student background that cause differences in outcomes. We know these two groups are exactly alike at the start on average, and if we observe differences in their accomplishment over time, then we know the difference has to do with which kind of school they got into. So there have been three experiments, random assignment experiments, one in New York, one in Chicago, and one most recently in Massachusetts. And all three found that students admitted by lottery to charter schools significantly outperformed students turned away by lottery.
Not in Chicago.
No, that's true in all three.
Carolyn says not Chicago.
Okay. The most recent one and most interesting thing about the Massachusetts study that was just released involving Josh Angrist and Tom Kane, among others, is that the only kind of charter school that didn't seem to produce this result were what were called pilot schools, which were the union-operated charter schools. They didn't work. They didn't produce superior results. They didn't produce worse results either. But I thought that was interesting, too. So it suggests that one of the things that charters can give us is increased flexibility over labor within schools, increased flexibility in who's hired and work rules that might enhance motivation and productivity of the people in schools, which leads to better results. Now, if we look at vouchers, we have 10 randomized experiments there. But my point is that it's perfectly possible that maybe KIPP's results can be explained by some sort of selection. But these lotteries control for selection, right? Their selection can't explain the results because only chance determines whether people get in or not.
Mine was not a critique of charter schools,
uh-huh.
Nor is it anything other than a critique of what I consider the inflated claims of KIPP.
Right. Well, in fact, actually, until KIPP does a random assignment experiment, I would join with you in being skeptical of whether the results are as good as they say they are.
But I think lots of charter schools have done valuable things. I think mm-hmm. they're with us for good. I think they do offer important choice, and especially they offer incentives for teachers, mm-hmm. community groups, and others to shape schools to their own wish. Mm-hmm. I think that's all to the good. So maybe we could be less abstract for a moment mm-hmm. with both the most concrete and abstract thing of all, which is money. Jay, you have said over and over again, this piece of data, which is a true piece of data, as much as data ever is, that we've spent more and more money with flat results.
Mm-hmm.
And it illustrates to me at least something problematic about certain kinds of statistical data. Because certainly, each of the three of us, I'm in schools a lot, so I see this clearly, could walk into schools and say, sorry, money is a problem in this school. There are no science facilities. Classically, the whole environment tells the kids who are in it that they're not valuable. Now, sometimes that is because, as was the case for a long time in the Chicago schools, certainly in the D.C. schools, lots of money is being creamed off by various forms of corruption. The fact is, you can walk into any number of schools in urban districts in which more money is needed for teacher aides, whose presence makes a big difference in instruction, especially depending on the level, and how many special needs kids you have and what kind, where facilities are not adequate to the kind of instruction the kids need.
Right, but that's it's a different point to say that there are schools that are lacking in things that money could buy. That is almost certainly a true statement. But it is not the same as saying if we were to give that school system more money, those schools would have the things that they need. Because, again, it has to do with whether people making decisions about how that money is allocated are experiencing consequences for the quality of the decisions they make. So if they allocate the capital, the resources they receive...
I want to interrupt you for one second. I mean, sure. It seems to me we have public institutions which are very public, which don't produce results... which aren't dependent on individual incentives and which seem to work pretty well. So I'm back to my military comparison.
Sure. Right?
Now, a big difference in the military and the schools, there are big differences. One is that there is a clear ranking system and you can more or less move up the ranks. I mean, there's a reward system. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me a useful lesson, that schools mm-hmm. ought to have something that looks more like a reward system.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a very clear demonstrable outcome of success and failure. You either take Baghdad or you don't. Right? You win the Battle of the Somme or you don't. Right? So it's critical moments. There's a clear, you win and I lose kind of quality to it. But those critical moments don't happen very often.
Right, so deterrence largely is one of their outcomes. It's really hard to know how successful were they.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think that roughly speaking, the military may be a public institution that doesn't rely very heavily on the incentives, the individual incentivized systems of reward and punishment.
And I'd wager that the military is almost certainly grossly inefficient in its pursuit of its outcomes.
We might think that we wouldn't want a private army anyway.
No. I'm not saying that it would be easy to introduce
quality of publicness. It's not easy to introduce. There's a quality of publicness that is an inherent good in a thing like a military for a democratic polity. I would argue, you've heard me argue endlessly for the last 2 days, that that's also true about school systems. I'm not sure what other institutions.
There is considerable privatization of a sort. Let's pretend.
Yeah, but we don't. We really are we fans of privatized military service in Iraq these days? I'm not.
Let's say to achieve our foreign policy goals in a particular country, rather than sending our army to Baghdad, we sent the Saudi army. Not directly, but we provided them with equipment and training and. We might not entirely mind that. Is it essential that the analogy is going to break down?
I mean, there isn't a comparable.
And it's a bit
analogy.
Like extraordinary rendition. I don't think I would recommend.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm a big fan of that. In any case, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think we need. I want to change the subject a little from this question of kind of individual incentives for teachers, because I think there's a lot more to be said about schools and that we should be talking about some other arenas as well. Certainly not instead, but as well. And that one of the things we need to do in thinking about schooling is think about what is intrinsically and either necessarily or desirably public about schooling. And I would argue, I have argued endlessly, that a private system of schools in which individuals achieve more with regard to test scores or regard to graduation rates or something is in some ways a less desirable educational system than a public one with a variety of features of publicness, even if, I don't know quite whether I'm ready to say this last half of this sentence, even if sort of the outcomes for individuals are not on balance as good. I'm a little nervous about the last half of that sentence because you could obviously see with the sort of the balancing act that you got to play with there. But the main point I want to make is that so just as we – my reason for the military analogy is I think I at least, and I assume many people, would be just uncomfortable about a highly efficient private military system, which is the sole way in which we protect our borders and attack our enemies and blah, 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 blah. There's something intrinsically desirable about a public military system. I would argue, you can buy that analogy or not, maybe if you don't like the analogy, we'll just ignore it, that there's something intrinsically essential about the publicness of a public school system, which is not by any remote stretch of the imagination to defend the Washington, D.C. public schools, which are terrible. And so it seems to me we need to sort of separate out defense of the publicness of a school system from defense of almost anything that happens in that public school system. And that the answer is not just...
So what is the good thing of the publicness? What is it?
Well, I think it's partly symbolic. It's the claim that there is, that schooling is an essential component of creating, maintaining, fostering, developing in the future a democratic polity, maybe a liberal democratic polity, that there's sort of, democracy is about... Democracy is sustained through a particular kind of schooling, and that it's the publicness of the schooling is a piece of that. Now, it's got to have substantive content. It's not just a purely symbolic call. I think a second thing I would say is that there's more leverage over inequalities and either within a district, across states, across regions, across blah, 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 blah. Not very well handled by public school systems, but on balance, public systems have at least more capacity for leverage over deeply stratified inequalities.
Jennifer, I want to connect what you're saying and come back to the issue of funding, and I want to do that in terms of what I think is a crucial part of the publicness, and that to argue that one of the problems with urban education has to do with a public dimension which is hard to maintain. If you look at around us right now here in Western Massachusetts, but you could do this across the country, in California where I've just been, it's at pitch crisis, in fact. The funding cuts in public education are so bad that teachers will not be paid in California except by IOU. Because we have a cherished superintendent in this room, he certainly could speak better than I in detail to the consequence of the shortfall in tax revenues in this state, as in most states now, and the consequences they have immediately and concretely in the ongoing educational program of well-functioning public schools here. Now, how I tie this to publicness is that in smaller communities, one of the way public schools enact democracy is we fight a lot about them. And we can, because dimensionally it's possible to feel they're within some reach, right? We argue about budgets. We argue about the proportion of the town budgets that go to education. And one problem is that that has never been readily possible in the large cities. You know, we've tried decentralization in various ways in order to have local boards in cities. That didn't work for a whole host of different reasons. But it's very, very difficult. And when you eliminate elected school boards, as has happened in New York and Chicago and several other places, it becomes yet more difficult, though elected school boards are not themselves. One can't make good cases for many of them in cities.
Yeah, we talked about that earlier, that's right.
But it does seem to me that the existence of a public school system and the amount of the public revenue it requires means that at its heart, outside the mixture of students in a building, which I believe in deeply, it requires political participation of one form or another, of one level of adequacy or another. And that that one of the dilemmas now, and it's why of all the education myths that Jay goes after in here, the money myth is the one that really, don't say anything yet, you have it in the book, really gets to me because it is so easy to formulate it, and it's constantly formulated, so that one, in fact, doesn't pay attention to the way schools do need money. That he's quite right that if I allocate X number of dollars in such a way, it doesn't necessarily produce anything. But the absence of money, the cutting of monies in certain situations, make very large differences. And I don't think we should lose sight of that, and we should not talk about a money myth in that sense. And we should be very clear when we write that we're excluding this. Now, I come to money because I think that there are a whole set of questions that I wrote down before we started coming from Jennifer and Jay. And money, of course, is implied in the very metaphor of incentives and markets and choice. Right? These are economic metaphors. And if we could figure out in what ways money functioned productively as incentives for what things in education, we might be in a place. For instance, to take one of the things that we don't do. depending on where you are, you can argue that teachers are paid decently. You can never argue that public school teachers are paid extravagantly, right? I make all kinds
of... It depends, right? Some teachers are woefully underpaid, who are excellent and not recognized for their excellence, and some are woefully overpaid because they're not actually producing very much at all.
Right? Here I'm going to talk about a category and not particular performances,
All
right?
Mm-hmm.
You're right.
Right.
But I think in the category, they're not. For most students, for instance, who come to a college like Amherst, to be a public school teacher is to elect either downward mobility from their parents or downward mobility from what the college makes available as their prospects for the future. Now, we have students who do that, which is great, but the incentives are not there in any obvious way for them to do it. So what you know, and Jennifer knows, and I know, is that if tomorrow we pass a national law which create a minimum beginning teacher salary, say $30,000 higher than it currently is, and federal monies would subsidize this, and we went to, say, maximum at end of career, $250,000. I'm pulling these figures out of my hat. None of us, I think, believe that in and of itself that would improve the quality of people going into teaching. But we actually don't know that. We do not know that. Could it? Certainly, prestige in this country is deeply associated with pay. It's not absolutely associated. Would it increase the prestige enough if you ratcheted up the national pay standards for teachers that would create a set of incentives that would draw better people? How long would it take for us to know whether that experiment paid off, as it were? I'm saying this because it's true. Lots of bad teachers are paid salaries that they don't earn. I have colleagues here, I think, who are paid salaries they've never earned once. Nothing is done about it. We function because we're a good place, and so everybody here has to be good, and that's that, right? But and few people, this is one of the common arguments, go into teaching because of money. Well, that's true, sort of.
Would you have to increase it $30,000 for everyone? How about if you increase it $30,000 for really good teachers? Would you reward the really good people?
Well, what if we did a more realistic experiment?
$50,000 for
and
really
we said,
good people.
Starting salaries in 2 years for all teachers will be increased by X number of dollars for all incoming teachers.
Why for all? Why not for excellent?
Well, then we have a probationary system.
Oh. Well, I just want to, you know, it's a bit awkward because some of you have been listening to us for 2 days, so we're repeating ourselves, and some of you are new. So I apologize for those who've heard this before, but I do want to talk about this publicness argument because
I have at least one more point to make.
The public goals, we do have public goals from education, there's no doubt, but the question is whether it requires the public operation of schools to achieve public goals. That is, we might have public financing, we might have public regulation, but do we need publicly operated schools where the people employed in those schools are public workers? That's not clear at all. There are all sorts of public goals that we achieve through mechanisms that involve markets in a regulated framework, that involve decentralized choice. For example, we address concerns about hunger through vouchers that are called food stamps. People are given broad discretion within a regulatory framework to purchase food with those food stamps. But public goals can be achieved, and in fact, there's a fair amount of empirical research that chosen schools actually produce many of the civic goals we have from education more effectively than assigned publicly operated schools. And to kind of illustrate that point, let me ask a question that the people who've been at the seminar are not allowed to answer. What did Barack Obama, George W. Bush, Joe Biden, John Kerry, and George Herbert Walker Bush all have in common? People who weren't at the talk. What do they all have in common? No, not one of them spent a single day as a student in a public school. But somehow they're still adequate in preparation for leading
really
our democracy.
That's a serious argument.
I think it is, actually.
Come on.
Or think of it this way.
Talk about cherry picking.
No, well, our democratic republic existed, and with all sorts of severe problems, and we have severe problems today, but our democratic republic existed for well over a century without a system of publicly operated universal education.
I guess I would contest a little bit the phrase democratic republic for the last of the 19th century, among other things.
For the early part of the 19th century?
No, for the
last part of the 19th century.
The entire 19th century.
The entire 19th
century. I would not describe the 19th century as a particularly democratic era.
Well, it's certainly the case that franchise has broadened considerably, let's put it gently. But it's the case that the very people who wrote the Constitution, who founded our country, who had none of them went to public schools, none of them even dreamed of public
schools. The point is not that sort of private schools are bad.
Jefferson certainly.
No. That's not my point. Okay. Simply is that this suggestion that publicness is associated with public operation of schools, and that one can't really have respect for our democratic republic without them is inconsistent with our historical experience.
Two things that I think are, one of at least was suggested by Barry, and one goes out of there. One of the things that the publicness of public school, I mean, I think your question is a good one, which is why do the public goals of education have to be provided through a public mechanism? I think it's a fair question. And my answer was in part because there's a symbolic quality to having a public enterprise that's at the core of democratic maintenance. Just like a military, a privatized military just wouldn't be the same kind of thing, and that we care about that. So that's one answer. Second answer is, and this is one I think that Barry suggested, it's an arena for arguing about the content of schooling rather than simply going off into our own preferred direction with regard to the content of schooling. And I actually think that's both more difficult and very important, that you need to have the availability of a space, but also the requirement of a space in which people have to talk to each other about what matters for their children. And that you and I might well disagree on the answer to that, and one of us might well win and the other lose and be pissed off, and. But that's what the nature of a democratic enterprise, a democratic polity is about, rather than you're going to the school that you like the content of better than I go to the school. I think we lose a very great deal as a society, as a polity, as a collectivity, by not being forced to talk to each other about stuff that we find very difficult.
Well, I think under any circumstance we would talk to each other about the regulatory framework,
but if the specific content were essential,
why would we let people either opt out of public schools into private schools as they currently can, or why would we let them move to other districts
the existence of private schools is something of a red herring. I mean, polities are never pure, right? And the fact that you've got a relatively small, 10% of the population exception. I mean, we also permit homeschooling, which, fine. It's not a big deal.
Could wave your wand, would you get rid of them?
I mean, if I could wave my wand, would I get rid of private schools?
And
probably
homeschooling,
not.
Too?
I would.
You would?
Absolutely.
Because I think the idea of, if parents are sufficiently committed to, A, pay taxes and live in a public school district, and find the resources to send their kids, partly the point that most private schools are parochial schools, weighs heavily with me. I think people, if you care that strongly, this is not a lockstep argument that everybody has to be in exactly the same precise structure for the...
But they're opting out over that conversation about content.
Well, I think that's too bad. I would prefer that they come back into that content. But, if it got to be 50% of the system were private, I would start getting very nervous about that. But, democratic polities have blurry edges.
There's an important difference here.
One more last comment I want to make just about the publicness. And I think it's why I think the analogy with sort of healthcare, housing, hunger has bothered me for the last couple of days, and I never quite figured it out until just now, which is that education is a collective enterprise. So we are not, in fact, educated the way we are fed, which is to say, I eat my dinner, and you might sit beside me and eat your dinner, but it's an individual thing that I'm doing. My health, my food, housing is a family thing. But much of what the process of, the reason students come to Amherst is partly the fabulous teaching and the wonderful administration, but it's mostly because they have a bunch of really smart peers that they're hanging out with. and they learn probably at least as much. Certainly my students will tell me this about why they come to Harvard. It's the mutual engagement in the educational process is a very large part of what both education is about and what publicness is about and what democracy is about. That's not answered, in my view, by saying that in a given private school you may have more racial integration than in a given public school. I'm absolutely sure that's true, and it's sort of largely irrelevant to me in some ways. Even if it were true of every private school compared with every public school. It's the creation and maintenance of a structure in which people necessarily have to interact. Adults have to interact around the content, around text level, around a whole bunch. And the kids have to interact. For my taste, we would structure the interaction among the kids somewhat differently. But
do you think the privateness of Amherst undermines the achievement of the communal activity of education and the public goals that are related to that?
Yes, well, for much of its history, it has.
Well,
and I'll say it clearly.
Should you guys seek out the Commonwealth and say, sign us up?
No, but...
In part, it's also a ratio issue. I mean, most higher education is, in fact, public, and I think that allows a safety valve for private higher education, analogous to the way the fact that most K-12 schooling is public.
But they're opting out of that collective discussion about the content.
Well, I think that's...
And Jennifer, both. There's at least a problem here, which should be, I think, erased. To treat parochial schools with the language of private schools makes legal sense and no other. Substantively, parochial schools, in my experience, both as a product and part of them, and in the cities I work in, they are extensions of public education. They are available choices for people who have very few economic choices in schooling, and I value them deeply, as you do, for that reason. But the composition of the student body absolutely embodies one of the crucial things in Jennifer's book, and she stresses, about publicness and democracy, which is the mixture of people you can't control as an individual. They're not easily happy combinations of students. I think here, for me, the issue is actually what the upper and upper middle class have done over the last 25 years in segregating education. And when this place was, in my mind, terrible, in 1972 when I came, I won't describe some of what I faced in the classroom, it was filled with one kind of person. Now, there were variations in terms of temperament, etc. But I think in the last 20 years, arguably, we in this country have produced the most ignorant elite in history, and especially dangerously ignorant because they think they know things they don't know.
And Amherst managed to make progress on that despite its privateness?
Because we had lots of money, and we had a president with vision and a commitment that goes back a fair ways about increasing the amount of financial aid and the diversity of students coming here. So unlike most in that small segment of elite private schools, we have enough money here to produce a mixture of students, which is democratic.
I just find it curious that we have fairly extensive choice and competition, publicly financed with vouchers in preschool and in higher ed, but somehow between the ages of 5 and 18, we allow some of it, but very little of it.
But you know the reason why. Mm-hmm. That the reason why is that we have no publicly sustainable mechanism to force rich people to share their public educational resources with less rich people.
Yeah, we do. We tax people, and then we give poor people vouchers to obtain pre-K, which is how we.
Right.
And we tax rich people, and we provide poor people with Pell Grants and subsidized state universities. And
you were talking about the middle area.
Oh,
from
right.
Kindergarten.
Well, why can't we do that in the middle if we could do it on the edges?
Well, you answer that.
Well, I think it's a path dependency of the fact that we happen to develop a system of government operated schools in the late 19th century for the ages of 5 to 18 and our unwillingness to kind of fundamentally rethink that, and then the the organized and vested interests of the people who are employed in that system who would rather not have a change.
So you've just gone right by the fact that, I'll just use the New York example, uh-huh. although I could use California and other places, uh-huh. Chappaqua, Scarsdale, Connecticut, Greenwich, awful Greenwich. One could go on and on, all right? These are all places of immense, uh-huh. and even certainly in the present context, obscene amounts of wealth.
Sure.
In which the public schools are brilliant.
Right? Right. We have school choice to some extent. We have residential school choice. Always have, always will. But we that choice also exists in the pre-K and the higher ed world. That is, we have Amherst and we have UMass.
But K through 12 is what we've been mostly talking about. And the resources which produce many first-rate public schools, but very segregated, in every city, the wealthy suburbs are, as you both agree, public education is not a question. It's not a problem. They produce the results. Standards, they don't even have to think about standards. They just produce students who pass those tests.
But it's not a resource issue necessarily. In fact, in many cities, the city itself actually has more resources per pupil than the suburbs, D.C. or Kansas City, where actually the central city is much more well-funded than are the suburban districts. One of the fundamental differences between the suburban districts and the city is that the suburban districts exist in a more competitive environment. That is, people can choose which bedroom community to live in.
False. It's, that's okay. Totally false.
Okay.
The competition between Scarsdale and Chappaqua is meaningless, right? I like Chappaqua because they got more backyard than Scarsdale. That is not a significant...
No, it's because if Scarsdale
That's not why
slips,
they have good schools.
If Scarsdale slips and starts having lousy schools, right. they would lose residents and tax base.
No Chappaqua. Question, but that's not why they have good schools. They have good schools because they have really a near monopoly on a level not just of financial resources. That's why the definition of just money here
right.
is a problem. But they also have a monopoly on a whole body of cultural capital, both of assumptions they carry, of healthy kids, of decent medical care. You go on and on. Now, it seems to me that what you do is you produce a system in which the well-to-do can always prosper without any questioning. Themselves. And so it seems to me to talk about school reform in a serious way and to take that elephant and put it in the closet. Terrible. That also speaks to my question about the limits of your own argument in the American Dream book, which is a very rich and good book. But the elephant of the disparity of income and wealth in the United States is parked off the page, basically.
Oh, isn't that what the book's about?
If so, you assume the elephant too much.
We talk about it. There's a whole discussion in the book about sort of nested inequalities, right?
Yes,
state, the city,
yes,
the suburb,
yes,
the family, you know, right?
But then... then
the whole rest of the book talks about it. Somebody will read the book
but,
judge which of us...
But I have to stop us, including myself, so as to open the floor to any of you to take the discussion in any direction you'd like to try to. We'll see if we cooperate. Yes.
Well, the mic is coming. Let me just make an observation. I mean, I think that I think the book actually does try directly to talk about this issue,
sometimes.
But that what we have done the worst job of and what was most important is this issue of actually not racial segregation but economic separation. Segregation has a whole polemical quality to it. Economic separation and a huge number of consequences of it. And I think markets might make it worse. But it would be hard to make it very much worse than it already is under the public system. So, anyway.
I've had the privilege to work in the inner city, and also I presently work out here in Deerfield, Massachusetts. You know, I've been listening to you for the last, you know, hour or so. In a nutshell, in my opinion, what you're talking about is culture. It comes down to culture. I've worked in the inner city. I'll ask you a simple question. If you had the chance to send your kid to Deerfield Academy or send your kid to South Boston High School, where would you send them? And hold on.
I'm the weird one.
Hold on.
I would never send a child to Deerfield Academy.
And the question is why? Why? Why would you be hesitant to send your kid into Southie? And if you don't know what I'm talking about, then I'm out of the loop. But the reason why you wouldn't send your kid into Southie is because you'd have an ingrained fear that your kid would be hurt there. Never mind the lack of education. why people seek out, in my opinion, private schools first has to do with emotional and physical safety. There's a tremendous amount of kids in school in this country that go to school in fear. It comes down to culture. When you go down, when you talked about the suburban schools, you're absolutely right. Wellesley, Newton, Dover, those schools, they accentuate their culture in their school.
How do you change that?
Hold on.
Okay.
They're not split. They don't have a high transient population. They don't have 20 to 30 kids per day being brought down to the principal's school because kids are ripping away the fabric of their philosophy. The answer to those kids is that you're going to now charge schools $40,000 per kid. That's $800,000. No school has that type of resource. KIPP, if they get rid of their kids, they get rid of their kids because they don't buy into their philosophy. They keep the kids that buy into their philosophy.
That's correct. That's what they do.
Right? So as much as we're talking about money, that's one piece of the puzzle. But it really comes down to culture. When I shifted out of Boston into Deerfield, I felt like Dorothy in Oz because education happens in my school. Kids feel safe to raise their hand to answer a question without some kid giving them a look or saying F you to him. You know, all that cultural pieces that can rip away at a school. And we don't have to go to Boston. We can go out here in Western Mass. But if you look at the – here's the other piece I was thinking about while you folks were talking, and I really appreciate the fact that you invited me here. When you look at the 10 lowest MCAS scores in the state and compare their economics, and as you mentioned, the 10 highest scores, and you look at their economics, the magic bullet that we're missing is that the teachers that work in the inner city, and we close those schools, people don't get the fact that those teachers dig into their own pockets. They bring toothbrushes to school. They bring food to school. They create a safe environment for kids at school. And what we're doing is we're penalizing those schools based on MCAS scores. And that's tragic. We're missing the bullet on that, in my opinion. But thanks for the opportunity.
I would certainly agree with many things you say, but I'd point out that the distance between Deerfield Academy and South Boston High School, as you know, is enormous. And there's a great range of public schools in between, including in Boston itself. And I say that because it seems to me that one of the ways upper and upper middle class white people, mostly, justify their choosing to put their children in very expensive private schools is an ignorant understanding of where they live. The choice is not for them to send their kids to South Boston. There are lots of public schools of great excellence available to them. And it's an exaggerated fear of a world they don't know. That is the world they project onto people who are poor and working class. Now, I lived in D.C. and sent my kids to public schools there. But I would not have sent them to any public school in Washington, D.C. because I knew that I had to take each of my children in hand, as any parent would, and to think about what environment here in this complicated, mostly not very good urban system can they handle. I site-visited 20 schools. Now, the school they went to was quite integrated in all kinds of terms, but it was also a fully functional school, and some of the terms you're using. I had a colleague here, who was an expert in class, so-called, come up to me and say, you are willing to sacrifice your children for your ideological beliefs. Nonsense. I simply know more about cities. So I want to stress to you, I mean, there are all kinds of reasons people might choose Deerfield. But mostly, I think, in that context, they're not very justifiable because it's not they don't have to make the choice between South Boston and there.
Let me just add a quick comment. I think your point is a very good one about culture and one that we liberal academics have a very hard time dealing with because the sort of the language of culture of poverty sends us back to kind of 1960s literature that says, you know, black people are poor because they don't have a good culture and because they don't understand about parenting. And, you know, I mean, there's a sort of a political, polemical route to discussions of culture, which, you know, people with my political sensitivities have a very hard time talking about. So I think, A, we haven't talked about it, and B, you're right to raise it. And that it's very difficult for certainly any teacher, probably any parent, any kid, maybe even any principal. I mean, you know, this is not an easy one by any means. I think The closest I can come to thinking about a solution for this is back to a point that I started with however many minutes ago, which is has to do with districting and district boundaries, that the set of people that you go to school with, that you sit in a classroom with, if you can get a sort of a mix of schooling cultures at least into the school and preferably into the classroom, you may break up some of the really dysfunctional ways in which, you know, the sort of the anti-achievement or the anti-authority or the whatever it is that's keeping pit. That's very hard to do. I mean, you know, we tried mandatory school desegregation, and people who know about the history of Boston will tell you that that wasn't a radical, stunning success. I don't think it was quite a horrible failure the way that Jay described it earlier, but you know, you can't force parents to send their kids to a school that they're afraid of. Whether or not they should be afraid, they aren't. So I think this is a really hard. I mean, my suggestion earlier, yesterday, was sort of to redistrict in a way that would generate sort of pie-shaped wedges, so that you have a relatively small fraction of the sort of the difficult schools, difficult culture, if you want to put it in that language, combined with in a single political unit, single academic unit, a larger proportion of, you know, roughly speaking, inner ring suburbs and outer ring suburbs, and so they feel like they have a sort of a collective responsibility for each other, and, you know, you'd have to spend a lot. That's probably a political non-starter. So I guess all I'm saying is that I think what you've raised is something that's both very important and very difficult both to deal with and actually on the ground, but also very difficult for academics to talk about.
It might be helpful to people if I mentioned an experiment in the Chicago Public Schools that I was involved in that tried to speak directly to what you're saying. And what we did was to gather teachers from troubled inner city schools in Chicago, of which there are many, and the many suburban schools of great resources, and to say, we're going to try to look for ways to voluntarily bring people together. We're going to do it by teacher exchanges. We're going to do it by having kids in read the same thing that kids in the South Side of Chicago are reading. We're going to then bring them together for discussions and so on. And we expanded that quite largely. And we called it voluntary exchanges of ignorance. And the idea being that the thing that bound us all together was different kinds of ignorances, fundamentally, yes, of each other. But we had the black kids in the South Side school eventually, when they got used to each other, take the kids on a tour of their, I must say, not easy neighborhood, and vice versa, and then sit down together and talk about what people thought they'd seen and how they responded to it. It was an extraordinary exercise. And the warmth and bonding between those kids over time was extraordinary. Without technically removing them from their schools, but, you know, transporting them back and forth in these kinds of ways. Now, it's small. The idea of it eventually, we hoped, was to create partnerships between suburban schools and urban schools that would allow for yet more extensive work. Now, if you do this selectively, that gets difficult because parents start to get worried again for the same reasons that you say. And Jennifer's right, you can't tell people not to be worried. It seems to me that part of what we need to do, and that's a version of crossing district lines that you've described.
Different.
But it is a version. So another question from someone. Gus, she's going to bring you a mic.
Hold on 1 second.
I think these are very difficult things to talk about, and this whole conversation
changing
is
tapes.
Very interesting. I think the comment about culture is extremely important and shouldn't be discounted. I don't think you meant to discount it, but I think it minimizes it to say that we're simply talking, it's a cold word to talk about the difference between black culture and white culture. We're talking about public education system that's trying to educate so many kids in this country. That's one factor that's very important, the largeness of it. Because when we do that, we have to accept the fact that the common culture, the culture of the small towns, not of Amherst, okay, but of other towns, is going to play a big role in the kind of education that kids get. I deal with that every day because I've moved into some different school systems, but culture does affect the schools we have. The other thing related to that, we started off, I thought we were going to a very interesting comment about the importance of teaching, and then we quickly moved away from it. If I had to say there was one thing that makes a difference, it would be the quality of teaching, and that's what we should be talking about. I would go further to say, and
how do you get it?
What?
How do you get it?
I don't have an answer. I say these are very difficult things to talk about, but I think that is what we should be talking about. Why, if there is a difference of teaching in Scarsdale, when compared to South Boston, we need to understand why that is and what we might do about it. And whether, in fact, it is really a difference in teaching or whether it is, in fact, an effect of people adjusting to a very different cultural environment and adapting their teaching to that. This would be a long discussion, but I think much of the language that we've spent talking about today is part of what's going on in our country today, which I think is very wrong-headed. When we talk about measuring schools, the whole discussion of resources, first of all, I don't think there have been any more resources added to education in at least the last decade or 15 years in Massachusetts. Numbers change, but basically we get the same kinds of resources to do the same kinds of things that we've always done. I don't know if that's true everywhere in the country, but I also know that I've seen school systems in other places. It's not the dollars that's spent that makes the difference. I mean, surely Chappaqua and Scarsdale spend a lot more, and they do attract probably stronger teachers because they're competing against the market of other districts, and they have the choice of the best. But if you go to China or Japan, they're spending a tenth of what we spend on education and getting good results. If you want to think about that, they do have good educational systems. I've seen education classes in Guinea where people are sitting on 50 kids, 5 years old, are sitting on dirt floors in a building that has a thatched roof. There's no cost to the education, practically. There is a teacher in there. And while they don't provide the same quality we do, they're educating their children. So I don't think that counting the dollars is the issue. And I really worry about the current discussion when you talk about productivity. The only new resource that has really been added to education, as far as I can see, is we spent a lot of money on testing kids, and with no reason to no theory about how that makes a difference in kids' prospects as they move ahead. We're looking, I think, at the wrong things and not trying to correct or improve the things that might make a difference, but they're difficult.
What's the cost of testing a kid?
Well, in Massachusetts, they've spent a lot of money on it, and Massachusetts has probably the best testing system in the country. And there's people are so blind. The results just came out on the TIMSS test. In Massachusetts, which was a state allowed to compete as itself, was close to the top in the world. Close to the top in the world as a state, and yet we have been telling ourselves and saying over and over and over again, we're not doing a good job educating kids. I mean, I'm not sure what the goal is, but I hope we all realize that we're not going to get all kids to achieve at high levels. Okay? It's not the nature of what the educational task is. We have a wide variety of people with different interests, different backgrounds, different abilities. American educational system is one of the wonderful things about the American public education system is what it has attempted to do in taking on all kids and trying to educate all of them. So yes, we can look at vouchers in charter schools too. In Massachusetts, I don't know how you can even do an experiment on them. They've done enough research to know that the charter schools, if you look at how many students with special needs are in the charter schools compared to the public schools, it's far less. And that makes a huge difference in what we do in not comparable schools. So to say that the results at a charter school are better than a school that's a public school, if they have essentially a different population of kids, it's not a good experiment. I'm sure, many fine public charter schools. There should be. Give people a chance to create a new school, create their own culture in the school, and some of them are going to succeed. But trying to do that for the millions of people that we have to educate in this country, I'm not sure, I don't think that's feasible. It will work perhaps for a few, but not for all.
Thank you.
Can I make, you you've talked about so many things. I guess maybe all I want to say is, first of all, I think, repeat what I said a minute ago, that sort of culture does matter. And by saying that, sort of, I was focusing on kind of the 1960s literature on cultural poverty in the black community, I wasn't meaning to say anything remotely like black communities have culture and everybody else just. All I was trying to say is that liberal academics have a hard time talking about culture because it grows out of that very particular debate, which made us all nervous as heck. So it was just a small point about the line. The other thing I would say is sort of teachers. I mean, yes, teacher quality. I don't think we have sorted out very systematically. Maybe you people who actually do schooling, rather than those of us who talk about it, have. But how we think about the relationship between sort of improving the quality of teachers, getting somehow better people into the teaching environment, either through incentives, through higher pay, through a ladder, through more autonomy, through something, as compared with improving the quality of teaching, which arguably starts with the same set of people that you've got because they're the people you've got, and figuring out what can be done within a particular school or within a particular district with people whom you would not ideally have chosen, but there they are, right? I mean, so those two things are related, but they're actually quite distinct, probably. One's a sort of a change over time, and one's as compared with, and again, I'm mostly, I think, just reflecting on a comment you made, the school context, right? So that the whole question of endogeneity, whether the environment in which you're teaching causes you to be a better teacher or the reverse, or how that relationship works. Or one more broadening sentence, sort of the social context, and that's get back to your point earlier about sort of the social context within which the school context occurs, within which the teaching occurs. So there's a lot of causal arrows going here, and I don't think we have a good handle academically on kind of do good teachers create a good context, or is a good country educate teachers. And I'm guessing that you all who actually do this don't have a particularly good handle on sort of which is the first lever. I was talking about this afternoon in the class. Which is the first lever you want to pull? Right? Is my primary focus going to be on hiring the best brand new teachers I possibly can and screw the rest of them? Or is my primary focus going to be on dealing with the culture in the school that doesn't permit kids, whatever? And so if we had some clearer sense of kind of which is the first lever among at least these four things that I'm talking about, there's probably many others. And maybe you do, but
I want to disagree with some of the factual claims because I think they're off, and I'm sure that you're, in the trenches doing what you do. That sometimes it's hard to kind of see certain trends that occur, and so it may be easy to be off. But I think you are off about some basic facts. Like, have there been more resources devoted to schools? And I don't know your schools in particular, but I can say that even if you don't think money is the way to measure it, and I'm not sure why we wouldn't think about money as a resource, but let's say we think people are a resource. There's been a 40% increase in the teaching workforce adjusted for any change in the student population in the last three decades. The student-teacher ratio has dropped from 22 and change to 15 and change during that time. So it's not just money; it's people that we've been devoting, and that's where if we've had a doubling in per pupil spending during this period, and you want to know where did the money go? Well, about 40% is going to more teachers. Real pay for teachers adjusted for inflation has gone up by something about 10 to 15%, which is actually very small. We've put a lot more resources into more teachers rather than more pay for teachers, which, by the way, is an interesting trade-off, right? There's a pool of money available for labor. We could decide to either hire more people or pay existing people more. We have generally made the decision to hire more people rather than pay those people more. That's the decision we've made. But that's where the money, where over half the money's gone. The rest has gone into expanding the kind of compensatory and supplemental services that we provide. Now, your suggestion that testing somehow is a large portion of this, I think is completely mistaken. The cost of testing, that is the cost. Okay.
I agree.
discussions. You use the word productivity, and I think I heard in there productivity, in other words, test scores. Okay. Everybody's looking at test scores, and designing new tests.
How would we know whether Hadley's doing well or not? Let's say I'm a taxpayer in Hadley, and I you know, you come to me and say, we really need to increase the levy to provide more money, but not really, I don't know, more money for schools. And I would say, okay, I'm willing to do that if you can convince me that something good will happen as a result. What would you like to show me if you don't want to show me?
In Massachusetts, I would show you those TEMP scores. I mean, I think if you get those kinds of TEMP scores...
That tells me... First, it tells me about Massachusetts, not about Hadley. Right? And second, it tells me perhaps something about the demographic profile of Massachusetts, which is wealthier and wider than most of the Union and than many of the countries competing in TIMS.
Yes.
And so it doesn't tell me about the value added or progress made by those students. So let's say I wanted to know whether in exchange for giving more money to Hadley, would I get some progress in exchange? How would you demonstrate it to me?
Okay. I have to bring us to a sort of end, but not a conclusion.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like to do it by especially trying to connect something the two teachers who've spoken have said, teachers and school administrator. I think that one of the problems with a lot of the school reform work of the last 10 years is an over-reliance on overly aggregated data. That is to say, when I look at Gus, who's part of whose career I know something about, he's now superintendent of schools in the neighboring town here. The difference in town cultures, which is yet again different from school cultures, between these two towns who are literally adjacent is enormous. You put Hadley into the mix. I got in trouble at our dinner the other night because I think the Hadley schools are first rate and they're among the top scoring ones in the state. Amherst faculty do not think the Hadley schools amount to anything. And why? A, because they don't know shit about them. And B, because they're snobs. And C, because there's a small school they think of as utterly homogeneous, which it once was and is more so than the Amherst system, but is less and less so. But it's a very small system. It's a very interesting. And these three systems, you could do a brilliant study about. Now, I also happen to know something about Deerfield, which I really don't like. But the difference in culture, between the culture of that school and the culture of South Boston High, and any point in between we chose, is enormous. How does overly aggregated data actually service here? Now, I know an answer to this question, but I don't believe it. Because if I look at that ratio, which is nationally statistically of 15 students to one teacher, it doesn't help me at all when I go to the poorest neighborhoods in L.A., where the ratio of teacher to students in every class is 1 to 45 minimally and not enough seats and literally not enough room to fit them all into the room. Right? Now, that, for me, is important data. Mm-hmm. And the national data is not just irrelevant, it leads people into truly false places. And he is smart enough to know this and to be more refined. So, with all that said, for me, teaching is the center. How you produce a culture in which good teaching thrives, Jennifer's question really, seems to me the key one when one thinks about schools, and the hardest one. And I think I have ideas about it, but I don't have ideas that I could make systematic, which is where these two people come in, because of course we brought them here to do everything for us and to answer all these hard questions, and they have failed.
We have indeed. I certainly have.
So
proudly.
So at the end, I want to say three thank yous and then an invitation to the people who have remained. One is to Pat Allen, who did all the real work that made this place function. There is nothing like being what I call a false front. It's what I think good teachers really are at their best. We have so much behind us, and in front of us disguising our incompetence, and Pat was mine. Person this time, and she did lots. I also want to thank both Jay and Jennifer for being always good sports, which is not easy in these discussions necessarily, and lots of fun to be with, and I hope producing some thought-provoking moments for all of you. So.